Hope is the thing with feathers.
Hope is the thing with feathers.
That's like a bird.
Like a bird.
That perches in the soul.
That perches in the soul. Welcome to the Thing with Feathers podcast, a podcast about birds and hope. I'm your host, birding enthusiast, Courtney Ellis. Welcome back to the Thing with Feathers podcast. I'm your host, Courtney Ellis. So delighted to have with us today, Laura Fabricky. Laura is the author of Keys to Bonhoeffer's House, Exploring the World and Wisdom of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. She is an essayist, and most importantly, she is a birder who comes to us from just outside Washington, D.C. Welcome, Laura.
Thanks so much, Courtney. It's really great to be here with you.
It's so great to have you. Tell us all about you.
Thank you. I'm the spouse of a U.S. Foreign Service officer, so a lot of my attention is paid to different parts of the world, and I've done a lot of birding in different parts of the world. I'm a mother of three. My oldest right now is in the process of applying to colleges, which is wild and fearsome, and my youngest is a fourth grader, so then I have one in the middle, so I have wide wings in different places here of schools. And I'm also a doctoral student at the moment in systematic theology. I'm studying at a school in Leuven, Belgium. So it's called ETF Leuven. And I'm in the dissertation phase of my studies.
That sounds fun.
Yes, it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of like daily showing up to things. So yes,
totally. Yeah. I always thought I would get my PhD, and watching my husband get a PhD, I was like, oh, I don't know that I'm built for this. Like, yeah. This is intense stuff.
It is a unique ring of fire to walk through. Yes.
He said he just always felt guilty for not working on his dissertation. Any minute he wasn't working on his dissertation.
Yes. That is exactly right. That's exactly right. So it was actually, I reached out to you to talk because our time in Belgium had helped me to make sense of a question that was actually related to birds. And I published an essay, which maybe you could share in the show notes, in a magazine called Comment. And it's a journal of public theology. And it was about birding, but it was primarily using birding as a way to think about and explore the way women are often habitually ignored, particularly in history, but I would say even more lamentably in church history. And so we don't have to get deep into theology. I know this is a podcast about birds, but since I'm a budding theologian, I found the Beguines. I learned about the Beguines. They were a group of women that lived in the Middle Ages or the medieval time period in the Low Countries. So that would be parts of France, what we now call the Netherlands and Belgium, and some parts of Germany. And I wrote an essay about this, which people can access, that's called The Birds and the Beguines. And and we can talk about some of that, but I'm also happy to talk more about birds in general. So
I loved your essay, and I loved how you wove together the thing. You know, if we have some listeners who are brand new birders, and they may not know that male birds tend to sing and be louder than female birds. So tell us a little bit about that and how that impacted your understanding of forgotten female saints.
Exactly. So I think it's pretty typical for people to cut their teeth in some ways to develop their eyesight on male birds, because they do tend to be the flashier models of the pairings. So, it's easier to see the American, at least in our area, the American cardinal, the northern cardinal, or, other birds that will really catch your eye. And they kind of stand out against the snow or against a tree. And the female of the species tends to be a bit more subdued and still gorgeous, but a little harder to see. You have to kind of look for it a little bit more carefully. So I had been with my son, my youngest, I had been sort of beginning to train his eye to look at birds and to recognize them. And we were starting to become more familiar with the backyard birds that would show up at our home in East Flanders, where we were living in Belgium. And so we were getting to know the collared dove or the dunnock, or there were, you know, some different birds that would show up, the European jay. And it was at that time that I also happened to stumble upon it. It was probably through Twitter, through the birding world of Twitter, which it feels a little stranger now to talk about. Yes, exactly. But discovering essays that different birders had shared. And one of them was Ken Kaufman's essay about female birds. Mm-hmm. And he talks about how he himself is you know, obviously a birder and a very, he's a widely published naturalist. And he talks about as a young child, also training his eye on male birds and discovering that these, he started developing habits that he didn't really intend for them to become biased, but that they did. And they, in some ways, the habits themselves constrained what he was able to see in the world and how he measured the value, the relative value of different birds. And what he found was, and shared, was that the practices of birding, like actually starting to pay attention to birds as birds and not just trying to bag them for your own list, but paying attention to them as real creatures with real lives, and that actually helped him to shape how he practiced birding. And it helped to open up the birding world for him, where he realized that he had very habituated blind spots. And I was quite taken with the essay, and I was particularly taken with it because my son at the time was six, and obviously we were all kind of, it was easy to see the male birds, and I was paying attention to the fact that I was already training him in that. It was easy for us both to see them. So he and I started paying a bit more attention to some of the females. The construct of Ken Kaufman's essay, the way that he analyzed his own experience, helped me also to make sense of what I was learning about in Belgium with these female saints. So it was a movement of women called the Beguines, or the Beguinal movement. And they started sort of coming on the scene in these low countries in the late 1000s, the early 1100s. And then they were probably by the end of probably by the middle of the 1200s, they were starting to come under some, what we might call persecution or some pressure. But they were women who took simple vows, which meant that they were not legally binding vows. They always maintained a kind of freedom to enter into communities that were not actually formally monastic communities, but they were monastic-like. So they weren't quite, they were convents insofar as there were groupings of women who lived chaste lives of obedience, poured out to the poor, poured out to the vulnerable, and then also living in community themselves. Mm-hmm. And it was a way for women at that time to be themselves and to be to have a stable, safe place to live where they didn't have to become nuns and they didn't have to be married. So single women could join, and then widowed women as well were allowed to join. Once you married, you had to leave. But there were close to, like, we don't actually have like official census records of them, but there are some estimates that there were at the height of this movement, there were as many as 1 million women who were living across the Low Countries in these communities. What's interesting about them too, is that they did not, really have a figurehead. It seems as though it was sort of an organic movement of people that were very interested in living like lives that demanded more of them and that wanted to be poured out in service to God and to neighbor. And then also they, I think, wanted to step out of the usual pathways that were expected for women. Mm. What's strange though, is that, you know, I've been raised in the church. I don't know how many of your listeners have been as well, but you rarely hear about women who formed movements like this. Like, you certainly will hear of, you know, kind of rock star women in history, but the movement itself is, I think, woefully underrepresented in a lot of our studies of history, certainly, but then also in church history. Like, even if you're not paying it, if you don't want to pay attention to what's happening in churches, it's just not something that I felt like I had been exposed to. But as we were living in Belgium, I kept coming across places where Beguines had lived. And some of them are now art galleries or coffee shops. There are places where there are plaques on the wall. There are places that are still preserved and you can visit them. And you can learn about what the Beguines were all about and who some of their, you know, key figures were. But they were women who really kind of created a space that really didn't exist for women in any other sector. And offered, I would say, like an expanded understanding of what it meant to be a human, a citizen. And they gave us a lot of, I think, a lot of models that we now take for granted, like hospice care, care for the dying, reaching out to more vulnerable populations. So I found Ken Kaufman's framing of how little he paid attention to the female birds and how he needed that corrected as actually a really helpful way for me to frame what I was discovering about the Beguines in Belgium. And wanted to kind of lift up both for people who both care about birds and who care about history and where we might be overlooking people in our lives or overlooking people in history in the same way that we overlook the birds.
Mm, I loved that connection so much. We will link to both your essay and Ken's essay in the show notes, and I highly recommend them both. And I think your question of who are we overlooking is a really vital one, both for people of faith, but also for birders. I was at a bird festival recently. I went to my first birding festival out in New Jersey, and one of the naturalists was saying, you know, it's so tempting to say, oh, it's just fill in the blank, a house finch, a yellow-rumped warbler. You know, we were all there looking for these rare warblers, and it was like 10,000 yellow-rumped warblers. And by the time you see your 10,000th one, you're like, oh, okay. But she said it's actually paying attention to these common, ordinary birds that helps you, once you get to know them very, very well and their habits, their behaviors, their flight patterns, that is what helps you notice when there's a rare bird. Like by getting to know the common birds really well, every yellow-rumped warbler is an opportunity to learn something new. And I just loved that framing that every bird is a gift. There's absolutely no just.
Absolutely. I completely love that. And I think it takes practice and effort to sort of keep your imagination active when it is just easier, faster, simpler to find the flashy thing, to find the thing that's catching your eye, that's sort of the new thing on the scene, rather than, oh, here's these crows I see every day, or or whatever is the common thing that we're accustomed to seeing, and appreciating them for what they are.
Yes. And that is what so much of the monastic tradition and the tradition of the Beguines and these other spiritual groups, one of the things they have to teach us is that the ordinary is holy. The ordinary is sacred. And I think as a parent, you know, my kids are a little younger than yours.
Yeah.
I'm wiping the table for the eighth time in a single day. And it doesn't feel holy. It feels like drudgery. But the reminder that that can be used for my good and for my sanctification and for the good of the family is just, it's just a reminder I need every day.
Yes. Yeah. I totally agree. Having done that, it's very true. And it takes so much practice to stay present to those kinds of things, to stay present to the ordinary call of whatever the sparrow is that you're hearing outside. That's right.
Yeah, that the ordinary has its own specialness if we're attuned to it, if, like you said, if we're present to it. So how have you learned to be present through your birding practices in all of your travels? Where has the Foreign Service taken you? And how have you learned to be still while you're constantly on the go?
Well, I need to credit my father because he, I think, began my own habituation into spotting birds. So he would always call out different birds that he would see. Like if we were on long family trips in the United States, like in the car, he would often say, oh, look, there's cedar waxwings, or oh, American kestrel. And then he also, one of the really precious habits that I didn't even realize he was instilling in me, but he would, instead of calling for me and my sister in big public spaces, he would often whistle the white-throated sparrow's call. And I had no idea. It was just like a simple motif, you know, that particular call. And we just knew, oh, that's Dad. He's, you know, it's kind of weird. but it's now become something that I think of. It's paired in my mind in a very deep way to, obviously, to my father and And sort of the singular and special thing that he did to call us instead of just yelling our names. So I was already starting to, without me being really conscious of it, to sort of be habituated to pay attention to birds. And then what I have found is that birds help me get out of my own head and help me to, ironically, to stay grounded, even though they're often in flight. They help me just to stay sane when there is a lot of movement and bustle. And so I have turned to birds. Like, I wouldn't say that I'm still an amateur birder. I'm not going to festivals, but I do get out and I do so purposely to see what bird might be given to me. Mm-hmm. And to receive it. So when we have, I would say like in our service in the U.S. Foreign Service, the birds that we would see in our first assignment in Doha, Qatar, really the places that we would see birds were in the rafters of grocery stores, like big box air conditioned mm-hmm. grocery stores. They would get caught there in the buildings and the outside heat was just oppressive. So we all mostly stayed indoors anyway in the air conditioning. And that's where I would typically see birds. And I found it to be kind of pathetic and sad, but they really meant a lot to me when I would go grocery shopping, seeing them there. We then lived in Amman, Jordan, and the bird that I find, that I turn to in those memories is the hoopoe, the Eurasian hoopoe. And they just have, again, like very flashy, catchy kind of crown on their head. And we would just see them in the countryside and I would make sure that our kids saw them too. And I think that that's probably the best thing as a parent that you can do is just make sure your kids are not overlooking things, because birds, all of nature, it doesn't have the same kind of voice that the human voice does. And we often have to get quieter and we have to learn how to look into nature and to see it and to see what we're being given. So it's, and I think that that's obviously it's how my dad patterned me and it's what I'm trying to do with my own children. And so I have more consciously done that with my son, my youngest, but my daughters appreciate the birds as well. But he really took to it. So he and I really do share that. And I love seeing what he's taking up as well, what he sees outside.
It's fun when it sticks within the family, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it really does. It does.
there's a specialness to being able to share something you love so deeply with someone you love so deeply.
It's true. Yeah. And I feel like with birds, you kind of no matter where you are, you're going to see something, you know, like there's always an adventure out there. So it's fun to know that there's a world out there that's waiting for you that wants to be seen and known and appreciated. Yeah.
You used the language before of a bird being given and you being there to receive it. Tell me about that, because birders have very different perspectives on birding. You know, birders are as diverse a group as anybody else. And some are after that life list and checking things off. And some like to hunt, you know, not with a weapon, but with the binoculars. And others have more of this receptive posture toward birding. And that sounds like your posture. Unpack that for us.
Yeah.
What does it mean to
be given a bird. Yeah. It's really the way that I frame it in my own mind to relax my grip and relax my sense of control. It's fun to have a list. It's fun to know a place and to know there might be a bird that I will be more likely to see if I head out here, if I go to this area, and to be on the lookout for it. But at times you go and you're disappointed. And so I have this posture of, and I really do practice it. It is probably fairly monastic to say, I will receive what is given. Mm-hmm. And it does help me to appreciate what is very ordinary. And it also helps me to pay attention when I'm less likely to be paying attention. Mm-hmm. I find that birds for me have really shown up in ways that have kind of punctured the fog of my own busyness or just a overly great sense of myself. And if I see a bird, like often if I'm pulling into my driveway, for instance, we have a number of red-shouldered hawks that hang out in the trees that are near our home. And from time to time, I will either hear the crows mobbing them. They want to get rid of them. They're trying to, you know, tell them off and scare them away. I'll see the hawk swoop across our front yard. And often when that happens, it wakes me up. I realize, right, there is a world out here and I really want to be awake to it. And I have found that I have seen different birds throughout the world that have done that. And often I feel quite tethered to that location. I remember spotting a kingfisher in a spot in Germany that was just, you know, tucked under near a bridge on the bank of a very small river. And it just felt like I'd been handed a jewel. And just a really common bird. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't like, oh, I really bagged something amazing. But I can immediately return to that bridge and receive it again in some ways. It's like it was given to me and it remains mine, that memory. And I think that's what keeps, I think that's what, why birders like me find birding so sanity producing. Like it just, it helps us to stay calm. It helps us to stay present. And yeah, so I plan to keep doing it for sure.
Is it a spiritual practice of sorts for you?
I really think it is. You know, I know you're a pastor and I'm, you know, a writer that does pay attention to spiritual realities and seeking to be more of a professional theologian as I age. And I do think there's in scripture, there is a lot of attention to the significance of birds. And this is Abrahamic, this is biblical. And, you know, Jesus in his own teachings would talk about how wonderful it is to pay attention to birds and that there are realities to birding that help us to know what this world is like and how it's held together by love and that we actually, our anxieties really don't do much for us. They don't make us more secure. So you don't have to be anxious. It's not a requirement. It doesn't make you more secure. But you do have to practice. It takes practice to not be anxious. So birding is a great way to practice not being anxious, even if it's for just a time. Sometimes it's a short window in which you're given a bird and you can kind of go, oh, I'm practicing that. And develop a different kind of change the habits that we often have, I think, in our modern life.
Something unlocked for me when I began to understand these things as spiritual practices and not spiritual disciplines. And I think we use those terms interchangeably and they both have merit, but you and I are both graduates of Wheaton College. We were there at different times, didn't know each other there, but I think Wheaton had this very rigorous attention to, you know, spiritual discipline and growth in your Christian life. And practice has a totally different connotation. You know, my kids practice soccer because they're not David Beckham yet. And yes, I practice the piano because every time I learn something and something unlocks for me. And birding as a spiritual practice, which is, okay, what's the work that's going to happen on my soul versus I'm going to try really hard and get good at this. It's two totally different systems.
It really is. It's a good insight. It's a really good insight. Yeah.
I love your tethering of that to the idea of anxiety and how that's tied to control. And when you go out birding and are in this posture of receptivity, you've let that control go. What is God going to send to me? What am I going to be able to witness? What gifts are going to be given? And I mean, the world lights up when you're, when you're waiting with this expectation that you can't make that kingfisher show up, but God was like, you know what? Laura needs a kingfisher.
Yes, that's exactly right. And birders are fascinating too. Like one of the things that I've loved, if you ever get into the DC area, there's a couple locations that I highly recommend. One is the Potomac Overlook Regional Park. There's a fabulous naturalist there named Matt Felperin, who does something called an owl prowl, where we go out in the evenings. My son and I have done it a couple of times, and you go out in the evenings and listen or look, if you're really lucky, for barred owls. And you have to be really patient. There's no guarantee. He's so familiar with these birds and he knows, like, if we're standing here at this time of night, we're likely going to hear them talk. We might hear them swoop or see them swoop, but we have gone on this owl prowl and we haven't seen a blessed thing. and he can't apologize. Like, you just, that's what you get. And you show up, you try, and then other times you show up and try and you get just an amazing view. And so there is effort. Like, we do have to sort of put ourselves out there, but we can't control the outcomes. So showing up to practice is it's a great way of framing it. The other place that I really love, where I've also loved getting to know birders in addition to the birds, is a place called Huntley Meadows. And it's a regional park, and it has just phenomenal birding in the DC area. And there are a lot of people out there early in the morning with, you know, huge lenses on their cameras, and they're in camouflage, and they look really serious, like way more serious than I am. And I usually try to sidle up to them and I'll say, like, what do you see? And it's fun to look at the birds, but it's also fun and quirky to interact with the people that are out there. And I love that. So anytime you can kind of connect, birds help us to get into the stuff of life, including the people. And and to me, that's in equal parts as joyous. I think it's great to get to know people that, like, know more about birds, help me to learn about birds. I love hearing them argue. It's fun. It's a great way to get into the world.
1000%. Birders are a fascinating bunch, you know, from the outfits to the camera lenses to the, it's always funny to watch someone just struggling down the trail with, like, their giant scope and their giant camera. Yes. And I'm like, you know, I'm out here to be as light as possible. Like, I've got my iPhone, I take terrible photos, I've got my sunscreen on, like, that's what I'm there, but it takes all kinds. And watching the bird watchers is sometimes, I think, just as interesting as
It's so true. Moreover, I have noticed a real generosity. There's real generosity that happens out there, which I think is another practice that is great to get into. Like, as we'll depart from Huntley Meadows, there's a path that you have to take sort of out of the marshland into the woods. And often we're passing one another, and some people are entering as we're exiting and vice versa. And often what you do is you pass off, like, oh, there's something great to see over here. Or as you're entering, you say, what's out there? I want to know. And you kind of hand along the information. And that's a really sweet way of, you know, connecting with others and just sharing what's already free to us, right? Like, we don't have to hoard. It can be enriching to everybody without it being diminished in any way.
I think that's one of my favorite things about the world of birding is that expansive generosity and the very low bar to entry. Like, go sit by your window, look outside. Do you see anything with wings? There, you're a birder.
Exactly.
You know, there's so many hobbies. I'm out here in Southern California, and there are a lot of people who are really into surfing or really into mountain biking, and they're spending, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And then you've got to go to the gear shop, and then you've got to get the special wax and the this and the that. And the fact that to be a birder, you just need to be able to look outside or to be able to look in the air-conditioned supermarket.
Yes.
In a Middle Eastern country, because it's 1,000 degrees outside,
exactly.
There's probably a house sparrow in the airport. You know, wherever you are, you can be a birder. And that people with so much knowledge and experience are often so willing to share that. And that's not true of every discipline. You know, you move in theological circles, and I move in theological circles. And there were a lot of times in seminary where I just felt less than, because I hadn't read all of Hegel, or I didn't know Barthes' complete works, which, by the way, no one does. It's thousands of pages. And birding is like, it's really this deep gospel imperative of come and see.
Yeah.
Come and see what I have seen. And if you want, I'll tell you about it. And what a beautiful thing.
It really is. It really is. And we get to see things that we may not have seen before. Like, the world will keep opening up to us as we practice. Like, we will get deeper. Our eyesight will grow wider. Even if we can't see as well, like, as we age, we can hear, we can still know that the world is out there, and the birds are out there too. Yeah. So it's, that's what I loved about that Ken Kaufman article. And it helped me to see things in history that I think I didn't appreciate. It's helping me to see things today, and frame things today in ways that I wouldn't have in the past. So Yeah.
And for someone with such expertise, I mean, you know, for the folks who are listening who are newer to the world of birding, he's like, huge. He's like the Pope. I mean, like he, you know, like the guy knows everything and has been everywhere and has written these beautiful, insightful books. And for him to say, this was a big blind spot I had, like what a wonderful example of humility and continuing to learn and continuing to grow. And that's another thing I love about the birding community in general is there are know-it-alls in every community. And, you know, we've got some. I was at this birding festival and this novice birder kept sidling up to the expert and being like, that's a fill in the blank. And the expert was like, no, it's not. I don't know what he thought he was going to gain. He was trying to impress the guy. But in general, there is this, hey, we learned X this year.
Yeah.
And isn't that interesting? And that changes our whole framework on how we understand shorebird migration because we learned something new. And that is just a model, I think, for all of life. Like if we could do that in politics, if we could do that in, you know, every arena, it would change the world.
That's right. That's right. No, that's exactly right. And that there are people, I think it's important for us to realize too, that in a lot of systems where like systems that we typically take for granted, there are people that are doing things faithfully that are largely often unsung. Mm-hmm. And we take it for granted. There's a lot of heat in social media, and there's a lot of oxygen sucking with a lot of anger, a lot of high emotions. But there are people everywhere that are showing up and doing something faithfully and small and typically quietly. And it's good to pay attention to those people. Like these are the people that will help us continue on when things get tough, and to kind of try to become one of those kinds of people as well.
Yeah. When that finger points back at me, I'm like, am I good at this? I don't think so. I think I have some room to grow.
That's exactly right. That's right.
But I think noticing it and appreciating it is a good step toward growing into it, right? Like that is how I want to be. That is what I want to learn from. That is how I want to grow. I think about parenting and pastoring and teaching and, you know, these ways that your life and my life overlap and what it is to teach with that mindset versus the, well, I know everything and here we are. But when it's a shared journey of discovery, birding with your child or birding with a friend, or it lights up so many different things. So I'm going to ask you a very hard question. I want you to prepare yourself. Okay. This is the hardest question I ask on this podcast. Laura, what is your favorite bird?
It is a hard question. You're so right. It's like saying, what's your favorite child?
That's my next question.
Yeah. Well, who is your favorite child? Name it today. Name that child. So I have a special love for magpies, European magpies, for a particular reason I won't share here, but again, birds that have shown up in precious ways in my life, and they're intelligent, they're beautiful. And that I would probably say is my favorite bird. Mm.
Anything in particular you like about them?
I just think they look really regal. Like they just have a great look. Like they look like they're suited up and ready to go. And, but they're also, they're ordinary as well, even though they look fabulous. They're
fancy corvids.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right.
And like a crow, but
that's
fancy.
That's right. They're a crow, but fancy. And I admire crows a lot. I like the whole corvid group, I think, is just fascinating. They're smart. The work that they kind of do in the world, you know, picking at stuff that's on the edge of the road, or it's quite humble. And I love that pairing. And they tend to be like, they're very, you quickly get acculturated to them. And you just don't think that much about them. And I think there is something about the magpie that just looks spiffy. And I think that's nice.
They need spats. They look like they need spats.
Exactly. That's right.
I loved in your article, you described them as tuxedoed. And I was like, that's exactly it. We don't have magpies out here where I live in Orange County. And I traveled to Colorado and I was there for like 30 hours total. And most of it, I was in conference rooms and was so hoping to see a magpie. No magpies. You know, I'm borderline distracted driving because I'm just looking out my window trying to see a magpie between the hotel and everything. And I woke up the last morning I was there, and looked out the hotel window, and in the tree, two magpies. And I was like,
amazing.
I felt seen by God.
Totally. Totally. Like you were ready for them to be given to you. Yes.
Yes. They were fighting over a trash wrapper. You know, it was so not a like pastoral, beautiful, idyllic scene, but like saw my magpies.
Exactly.
Lit me up for the rest of the day. Magpies are rad. They're so smart.
And yeah. And they've just shown up. Like when we were living in Berlin, I took a writing retreat, about an hour outside of the city, and a magpie just showed up, for me in a courtyard that I was sitting in. And it just felt important. It felt like something was getting marked. And I needed it. I didn't realize how much I needed it. And I've returned to that memory so many times. And, yeah, so that is totally why I love them.
Mm. Do you have magpies in DC?
We don't. We have none. Mm. So, we'll see if we're ever back in Europe, or other places where there are magpies, we will see. See if I...
They're out there. They're waiting for you.
They're waiting for me. I'm ready.
So, you're a woman in theology,
yes,
which can be a tricky place to be.
For sure.
It is male dominated. It kind of always has been, but not always to the extent we think. Just like you said, the Beguines and some of these monastic communities and some of the women in theology are just less loud and flashy, or we pay less attention to them. What has your experience been as a woman in 2023 in a PhD program in theology? Are you feeling seen? Are you feeling heard? Are you singing your song?
Yes. Am I singing my song is a great way of putting it. I am learning to sing my song better, and I'm learning to sing it not necessarily louder, but more wisely. I do think there is, I do feel an important sense of call to being a female there. And that doesn't mean trying to jam red feathers into my wings and trying to necessarily get seen. But it does mean being a full participant there. So it depends on how you look at it. So, yeah, it has not been easy, but I will say, at least I've had many men and women that have encouraged me in this path. My husband is one of them who encourages me, but people professionally who've encouraged me in this path. And, for that, I'm very grateful. So, I definitely feel seen and appreciated by enough, to continue on.
I'm very glad for that. Yeah. It is a unique experience being a woman in a theological world. I'm a pastor, so it's slightly different, but here in Orange County, it's definitely very male dominated in the pastor arena. And I go to, you know, events and things, and people assume I'm the secretary or I'm the wife or I'm the, you know, and I think part of, I turned 40 last year, and stepping into my 40s has been this: I don't have to justify my existence or my profession. I can just be here and know that I'm competent. I have worked for this. I, you know, can stand in this room. And I think I felt a lot in my 30s. I had to kind of self-justify and like, I'm going to be amazing. And to just be able to be confident in the skin that God has given me, in the room that's 95% male, you know, me and the secretary. And that has been it's a unique journey, and I'm grateful for partners like you along the way to have these conversations.
Yeah, totally. I really do see myself very much as I want to serve the entire church. I particularly want to be a person who serves women that are called into ministry and called into pastoral service, and doing the kind of sense making that I see the Beguines doing. I mean, the ones that we know of that we can name, some of them did writing, some of them did teaching and preaching, and women have been vital contributors to the church's history, to its teaching, and to ensure that we're paying attention to those birds, not to overplay it, but making sure that we actually can see those birds and that we remember them and that we appreciate the contributions that they have made, not simply because it's weird that they're women, but simply because they are human beings who've been called by God to fly and to build nests and, you know, all of that. Like, they're just part of the birds, just part of the ordinary bird culture. Yes. And so we, it's I definitely want to serve people like you.
Yeah.
Bring it on.
Bring it on.
And there is such a gift in receiving the messages of faith and spirituality from different voices. And I think that's true of male and female voices, but it's also true of the voices in the natural world that I think for so long, especially in Protestantism, I think the Catholics have in general done a better job than we in the Protestant world have to pay attention to those voices of the natural world. Not that we're worshiping creation, but that the creation is speaking.
Yes.
The birds are literally speaking, but also the trees and the rocks and the, you know, God has shaped this world to teach us a thousand things. But so often, I know I have been very myopic in my faith of what are the words on the page saying? What yes. is scripture saying? And to not neglect that, but also there are other books.
Yes.
There's the book of the natural world, and there's the book of friendship, and there's the book of parenthood that God wants to use and to open ourselves up to new voices.
It's true. And to do that, we have to get quieter. I sometimes see, I see squirrels, like Eastern gray squirrels outside. Sometimes I'll see deer coming through our backyard, and they can move so quietly. And if we are so consumed with ourselves being people, busy being people, we will miss life. Like, this is actual life. It's life that God cares about. It's life that he knows and made. And it's important for us, I think, as people to be still and know that God is God, but also be still and know that, like, God made this world and can hear it, like can hear what we are doing to this world. It's groaning, it's agonies, it's cries, and us getting quieter and being more still will help us to hear God better, certainly, but also to hear God's world. Mm.
That phrase of yours of what we're doing to it, that keeps me up at night sometimes.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What we're doing to each other and also what we're doing to the natural world. And that brings me to my final question before we talk about where we can find your beautiful book and where we can connect with you on social media and all of these things. In view of all that's going on in the world and in view of all that's going on in creation, where are you finding hope these days?
I am finding hope these days in friendships right now. I've been in a small group community of people that are practicing to tell the truth about their own stories more deeply. And we've been informed by some of the teachings of Kurt Thompson, if you're familiar with some of his writings. And we've been sort of trying to put those into practice in a kind of holy experiment. And I have found a lot of hope in that. There's hope in scorning shame, taking risks towards others, and really taking risks of faith. And that has given me a lot of hope that there are things that we can do, ways to hear one another better and to encounter each other that are more authentic and that help us to sort of right size who we are to one another. And that has brought me a lot of joy and a lot of hope. And certainly birding. There will always be the birds. And right now I'm appreciating, I know it's probably not true for you in Southern California, but I'm appreciating the fall leaves. And
we would like some of that.
Yes.
Here. We just have fire season and not fire season. Those are our two seasons.
I'm really appreciating the fall leaves. We were told because we had a really wet spring and summer. We were told in, you know, various news articles, it's going to be terrible. It's not going to look that nice, but it really is. It's beautiful.
Oh, I'm so glad for you. Yeah. You got to send me a picture too.
Yes, I shall.
And that book, the Thompson book, the Soul of Shame, is that the one you're referring to? I'll link to that in the show notes as well. It is a beautiful, beautiful book about kind of the spiritual journey away from shame and to greater flourishing. It's really good stuff. My husband owns the physical copy and now the audiobook as well. And is
super
recommended far and wide. It's all over our house.
Super.
Well, Laura, how can people find you and connect with you? And where can we find your beautiful book on Bonhoeffer and your articles?
Thank you. Yeah. So you can connect with me. I actually don't use Twitter that much, but that was one of my public, more public facing
Twitter's becoming terrible. So
Twitter is becoming terrible. So I'm really not that active there. So, but you can, I have a website, laurafabryky.com, and Fabryky only has technically one vowel. It's Fabrycky. I have a newsletter, and it's about writing and the intellectual life and joy. And that's where you would find me writing and sharing something about once a month. It's not super heavy. And you can find my books and essays just by Googling my name. The Bonhoeffer book is on wherever you can find a book. And my essay, The Birds and the Beguines, is with comment. And you can listen to me read it out loud. And it is also publicly available outside of the paywall at this point. So it's a comment. I highly recommend it as a journal. It's just some of the most thoughtful material out there. And it's a great resource for our world today.
Laura, thank you so, so much for the gift of your time and your magpies and your book and your writing. We just really appreciate you spending this hour with us on The Thing with Feathers today.
Thanks for welcoming me on, Courtney. I really appreciate it.
The Thing with Feathers is produced by me, Courtney Ellis. Many thanks to Del Belcher for the music, to Todd Peterson for the name inspiration, and to Emily Dickinson for the beautiful poem and for being in the public domain. Until next time, my friends, keep looking up.
What is it on your soul? Use it there.